Today's talk is given by Dr. Richard Kinson of Manchester University. His talk is entitled Participatory Online GIS for Adapting Our Towns and Cities to Climate Change. Dr. Kinson is a senior lecturer in urban planning and smart cities within the School of Environment, Education and Development at Manchester. He is the Deputy Director of CUPS within the school. That's the Centre for Urban Policy Studies. Richard has a background in planning practice, having worked for Leicestershire County Council and a number of planning consultancies before moving to academia, firstly as a research associate at the Centre for Computational Geography at Leeds and latterly at Manchester. He's been a lecturer in GIS and urban planning since 2003. Research interests include smart cities, public participation in GIS, PPGIS, and planning support systems. Recent research includes the EU-funded Smart Cities Project, which aims through the Green Home Watch to bust myths about heating technologies and thermal insulation, the EcoCities Toolkit and Spatial Portal, which is to assess Greater Manchester's vulnerability to climate change, and more recently the GRABS Adaptation Action Planning Support System. So whether, like me, you've been targeted by cavity wall insulation salesmen, or instead you perhaps have a wider concern over the risks posed by climate change, you should look forward to an interesting seminar. Richard.
Thank you. I think I'll sit down. Right, so what I want to talk about is work that actually goes back to when I was in the Centre for Computational Geography, so most of my academic career really. And I was just checking when the last time I was here was at GISROC in 1998, where we first presented our research on public participation GIS. And at the time, the project, you'll all laugh when you hear this, because it was, I mean, I was working as a planner, and there was a job advertised saying they wanted, this was Steve Carver, I think, took here a few weeks ago, they wanted a planner who understood about public participation, knew how to use GIS. And Michael, so I've heard about the internet. The project was to look at whether or not this thing called the internet and the World Wide Web would ever become a useful tool for engaging people in decision making. Our project was about using web-based mapping tools on the internet, which didn't really exist at the time. This was in 1996, 97. We basically started by developing the software using Java. We used Ordnance Survey landline data. Some of you will remember that data without the permission of the Ordnance Survey. At the time, a license. They didn't realise that they would put this on the internet, and when they came to ask us how we did it, one didn't care about it. Anyone from the OS didn't care about the license, they actually wanted to know how we'd actually technically manage to get that data into actually working on the internet. So we've been doing this kind of stuff for quite some time, but what I really want to talk to you about today is some projects we've been working on over the last three or four years. So we'll talk about some of the problems around climate change that's facing cities and how actually the solution to all of this is through a spatial approach, a spatial planning approach, a GIS approach to understanding the problem and also adapting our towns and cities through use of spatial data. The fact is, I talk about participatory GIS, public participation GIS, because within this problem of tackling climate change there's a diverse set of stakeholders. I'll now get on to some of the technical aspects about system design and development and the web map servers that we use, and increasingly now we may have towards web map services. And then finish off with how this has been supporting decision making in real places. Well, so we've been applying this research and this work in real cities across Europe. And then I'm just going to finish off with some demos and sort of latest developments of what we're doing. So, there's just going to be a series of images shown off while I kind of explain the background to what we have been doing. So, across the European Union, cities are facing a range of climate change problems. And there's questions about whether or not you mitigate against those problems, or whether we got to a point now where actually mitigation isn't going to work anymore. What we really need to do is be looking at about how we adapt. So this is happening, climate change is happening, and we need to adapt our towns, our cities, this goes on for, but each one only shows sort of 5 seconds or so. But this isn't, this is a global problem. But what you find when you look into a lot of these problems, and particularly when you read a lot of policy documents and listen to debates about this, a lot of the evidence that is supporting climate change and our need to adapt to climate change is actually supported by spatial data. GIS is at the heart of solving some of the problems around this. I've never seen maps like this in sort of climate scenarios and predictions. And there's been lots of work done. Certainly at the University of Manchester, we've been looking at how also sort of negative impacts of climate change. There are some positive impacts. One of our research centres recently published a report that was talking about how the northwest coastline. So at the moment, has anyone ever been to Blackpool? No. The greatest of places on the world. Maybe not the kind of place you'd want to go for your 2 week summer holiday. But by 2050, the way that the world is warming at the moment, the temperature of Blackpool and the northwest coastline will be very, very similar to the southern Mediterranean, to the south of France and Catalonia. So potentially there's a possibility there for investment in, there's some opportunities for that part of the country where you can see investment in the future because it actually becomes a value tourist destination. So there's all kinds of policy responses to this, lots of documents and discussions about what we should be doing climate change. And what we've done as part of the GRAPS project that was funded by the European Commission was to look at how we can support decision makers in adapting towns, cities and regions to climate change. And there's been a number of levels of this. For some cities within Europe, we've been having the job of actually convincing city mayors and city decision makers that climate change is actually a problem and a reality. And for others, it's been about explaining to them how we can use tools, the GIS tools, to support them in understanding the problem and then how they adapt to their problem. So it's really a spatial, to this slide here. So it's really a spatial planning response. And through spatial planning at an urban and regional scale, we can adapt our towns and cities through a whole range of policy interventions, but actual physical interventions on the ground as well, around green infrastructure, what we call green and blue infrastructure. So green walls, green roofs, and blue infrastructure, putting more water spaces into our towns and cities. So there's a famous case study from South Korea several years ago, where they dug up the central reservation of a motorway and replaced it with a canal that was only about 30 centimetres deep. But that reduced the temperature in that part of the city by 3 to 4 degrees just by putting some what's known as roof space into that. So there's a real value to having all this green and roof space and thinking about how we adapt towns and cities to green and roof space planning. And there is a massive policy, even Boris Johnson is not this, climate change is a reality. And across the world, here in Scotland, there's a Climate Change Act. Cities around the UK and around Europe are developing their own climate change adaptation plans. But underpinning a lot of these plans is spatial data. So we've been trying to persuade cities to tackle climate change and climate adaptation through a spatial approach. And part of this EU-funded project was funded by a part of the European Commission called Interreg, which is for inter-regional working. So there were university partners, but also city and regional councils across Europe. And the bit of work that we were involved in, which we essentially led, was to develop, as it says here, an innovative, cost-effective, and user-friendly risk and vulnerability assessment tool to aid the strategic planning of climate change. And this kind of follows, those of you who were maybe here last week, Stuart Barr's talk, although quite nice, Stuart Barr has been working with a colleague of mine, Sarah Lindley, doing a lot of the sort of offline data crunching within ArcGIS and the spatial analysis software. And what we've been doing is taking a lot of the output and putting that into some kind of online planning support system. Because the people that you have to sort of speak to and deal with on the ground who are tackling this problem are not GIS experts, they're not spatial analysts. They're policymakers and decision makers, planners, environmental scientists, and local councillors who don't have expertise in spatial data, we don't have expertise in using ArcGIS, back info, that kind of software. So we've been looking at how you involve different kinds of stakeholders, from grassroots community groups, individual members of the public, through to decision makers within systems, we can manage permanent green infrastructure, and look at the positive benefits of green blue infrastructure in cities, but how we can maybe think and alter our strategies and policies around thinking about, well, rather than that piece of industrial wasteland being redeveloped for commercial development, is there actually a better value for that to be developed as a park or some kind of green space? So planning support systems, are you familiar with planning support systems? They're sort of an extension of spatial decision support systems. So there's a whole range of these planning support systems. The idea was first suggested by Britton Harrison in the early 1990s. But it's essentially a combination of geospatial tools, GIS-type tools, and other modelling software and data analysis tools that you bring together into a sort of single platform to support planners and decision makers in supporting their decision making. But there's been, obviously, the growing importance of spatial data and the increasing availability of spatial data. So if I go back to when we first started doing these kind of tools, there was a real lack of spatial data. I think Digimap was in its early stages. You could access spatial data. But Ordnance Survey, very expensive. It's only in the last couple of years that they've opened up a lot of their data through OS Open Space. But historically, it's been very difficult to get hold of the kind of data that you require to help you make these decisions and support these decisions. And Jack Davidson, ESRI, obviously very positive about this, about GIS being at the centre of supporting decision making. And as I said, GIS will be the key mechanism for citizens to take an active role in local government. So most local authority websites now must be putting more and more of their spatial data online and increasingly providing access to the spatial data. But there is a problem that was noted there. I was first taught GIS by Stan Upshaw quite some time ago. We always used to have a box in his, acetates. We used to throw his acetates all over the floor. There'd always be a but. The big but here is really that there are lots of these planning support systems, spatial decision support tools around. But a lot of them, we build them in university laboratories, in GIS centres. But they don't get used. They're kind of one-off tools. And a lot of work done by Dutch colleagues, Guido von and Stan Gerten, looking for failures of planning support systems. We have an abundance of these toolkits available to us, but they tend to be one-offs. They don't get used. People don't sort of really use these kind of tools. And often, you could argue there are too many of these tools. But some of those on top of that, Map, GIS, and other bespoke tools. And often, it's due to the fact that people like yourself, I guess, looking at some of you in the room, I guess you're doing the RSC and GIS possibly. You go out into the workplace with your knowledge in your head, your skills, your expertise. You work in an organisation, you develop their GIS capability, and then you move on and you take all of that knowledge with you. All the knowledge that you know about GIS and the tools that you're capable of using, that tacit knowledge that is in your head goes with you when you move. It doesn't get left in that organisation. And suddenly, that system that you develop becomes redundant because no one else knows how to use it. So there's a lack of understanding by planners how to utilise and use these tools. And despite what we might read in journal articles and in AGI publications about the sharing of data within different local government, regional, central government organisations, there's lots of goodwill, lots of good talk about it, but the reality is that there's still huge problem around sharing of data within different government departments. And despite most local authorities now, so in my case in Greater Manchester, there's the Association of the Greater Manchester Authorities have a data portal. So they're making attempts at sharing their data, but it's still only the tip of the iceberg in terms of the amount of data that is available to what's actually being shared. I'll come back to this a bit later around some of the problems we face working with 13 cities and regions across Europe. Oh, I think I've got one of my slides. I think I have time to think about this. So. You just slip through as well. So some of the key questions we've really been asking then is how do we develop tools that can be used by a range of diverse stakeholders, as I said earlier, from individual citizens and community groups right through to more expert users. And we've been dealing with the Grabs project across Europe, different types of organisations. Some in some countries there are sort of data agencies, organisations that are sort of at arm's length of the local governments that deal with all the spatial data that support the local authority. There's a huge lack of spatial data, spatial mapping, GIS knowledge within the kind of people that need to be aware of the kind of data and the tools that can support them in their decision making. And there are different priorities around climate change for the cities that we were working with across Europe. When you're working at a European level, just the fact that there's different languages, so one might be sending spatial data that's in Austrian, trying to work out what the attribute table means, the headers and field columns, just those kind of practical things that you don't envisage at the start of the project. So yes, send us your housing data or something arising, you've absolutely no idea what the fields are referring to. And different levels of access to spatial data. And I'll show you a table in a moment where one of the partners only had three layers of spatial data available, and others that had into the hundreds. And when we're trying to build some kind of tool to support them in adapting to climate change, one of the real problems was the fact that some municipalities just didn't have any spatial data. They have GIS software, but they have no data. So different access to data is a real problem. And as I mentioned earlier, for two of the municipalities, real problems around convincing the politicians that climate change is a particular issue, even whether or not climate change is happening and exists. And the thing that really helped us with this was a project led by the Town and Country Planning Association and a fund through the European Commission called Interreg. And these just lists on there the partners involved. So TCPA were the lead, ourselves at the university were developing this adaptation planning tool. And then there are a range of municipalities, some at local authority level, some at regional level, and a couple of other universities and research centres around Europe that are experts on climate change adaptation. So I'll just briefly give you a bit of information about the GRAPS project. So it stood for Green and Blue Space Adaptation for Urban Areas and Eco-type Towns. At the time, you may remember the UK government were proposing that we should have a series of eco-towns around the UK. And local authorities spent a lot of time making proposals for eco-towns. By the time we got funding and got into the project, this idea of having eco-towns had gone away. I think there's only one actually built in the whole of the UK, just outside this stuff. But it was an Interreg project running from 2008 to 2011, four researchers, ourselves, but 10 European municipalities. So we had to build this tool for 10 local authorities and regions that have very different levels of access to data, different views and policies towards copyright of data. So we had real problems with the UK, well, the English local authorities who were absolutely obsessed, scared to death of all the survey at the time, because they thought if they started putting OS mapping on the internet, they'd be fine lots of money. This was at a time just before, by the time we finished this project, I think Open Space, a beta version of Open Space, had just come out. And I was saying to the partners all the time, don't worry, by the time we complete this project, we won't need to worry about this, but they worried about it all the way through. So there's a real, it's a lot different now, but at the time there was a real problem around copyright and open access to data. So the main aim of the project really was to develop good practice guidance, and each of these municipalities across Europe were developing an adaptation action plan, so a policy document. But underpinning that, the evidence base for this AAP was the adaptation tool that we were developing. So it was the GIS data, spatial data, that was the key to writing these adaptation plans. So these plans were informed by the assessment tool, and its primary focus, its primary aim was to highlight climate change vulnerabilities and risks, mainly in urban areas, but we have two regions, the northwest of England and a region called Styria in Austria. And part of the process was about awareness raising for people of different types who were still not sure about what climate change mechanism. So from local authority bodies that were responsible for developing plans and policies to adapt and mitigate climate change through to community groups. So a whole range of different kinds of stakeholders that we have to involve in this particular process. So, as I said earlier, the key thing that we have to do is to develop this online GIS tool to support them, to provide the evidence base for them to help support adaptation to climate change in the cities and regions that we're going to do. Now, let's sort of get into the bit probably more interested in, more the technical aspects of how we actually build this tool. And have you heard of Checkland SOT systems methodology? So Peter Checkland, a professor at University of Lancaster, he's in the business school just about, he's not retired, he's been close to retirement, developed this idea. This is a methodology about how, one particular methodology about how you develop software. And typically, what happens with software development is that the software developers are given some kind of brief, and they go away and sit in front of their terminals and code away for weeks and weeks, produce the software and bring it back. Here's your beta version, test that out. What the soft systems methodology does is put the user community at the heart of the development process. So rather than sort of saying, well, we're the experts, we know what you want and all, this is what the software can do, we might be able to tweak it a little bit. Soft systems methodology is all about understanding the user needs. And from that, you develop something called a rich picture. And that's a visual representation. Nearly like a cartoon kind of diagram. There's a great guide to what a rich picture is on the Open University site. There's a sort of YouTube clip. And what's actually good about that, the example they use is actually about flooding in the UK as well, so it's quite relevant to this. But if you're interested in this as a methodology for developing software and Checkland's approach, I encourage you to watch that clip. It's just the first 6 minutes is all you need to watch because that's the one all about rich pictures. And from that, you then develop what's called a functional specification. So that tells you what this software will do, the functions that it will do. And what we then do is we build from the functional specification. You can write things called UML diagrams. And that, from a UML diagram, a unified model language, which again is a visual representation of what the software is doing. You can convert the UML actually into computer code. And then what you do is you go out and do some prototype testing. We get feedback from that, we then update the system, and then eventually deploy it. But what you find is if you use this kind of language with lots of people who are not computer experts, if you start talking about functional specifications and soft systems methodologies, they all kind of glaze over. Now they become disinterested. And you have to develop things, what you call use cases, so a typical use of this software. So we sort of adapted the language slightly. Rather than talking about use cases, what we talked about was storylines. We came up with three storylines of a typical user of the tool to help these people who are non-experts to understand why it's important for them to use the tool. So there's a couple of references here. The one at the bottom, Checkland, is good as well about soft systems methodology and how it's developed over 30 years and how it's used. And the whole write-up of this, the tool that we developed as part of the Grabs project was published a couple of years ago. And this is essentially what we did. So we undertook a user needs and requirements analysis. So the starting point was going to the municipalities and saying, well, what do you want this tool to do? And showing them kind of screenshots, typically, of sort of maps in ArcGIS. And saying, this is the kind of thing you can do, explaining, you know, if you overlay a polygon layer with a point layer, you can work out, well, if these houses in this area, if you show a flood map, these houses are at risk. So a very basic kind of level of understanding for them to start with. And explain how you can assess vulnerability with a spatial approach. And then talk to them about the types of data that are there. And this was where it got their interest. It's trying to find the relevant person in the organisation who knows what spatial data is available. Is it becoming a time-consuming process. And what you actually often get to the point is there's about six people in the organisation who all have different access to different types of data and have never actually met each other. And this was the case at a large local authority in the south of England, that said one of the best outcomes of the whole project was the fact that about six different departments started talking to each other about their data holdings that had never spoken to each other before, they didn't know they existed. And there was some duplication of data, but there was also data sets that the housing department realised that the environment department had a data set that would be really useful to them. So we actually learned a lot through going this kind of, through this process. So there's a key problem there, really identifying the key stakeholders and getting through to those people. So a lot of the kind of things you think you get, so it's all about the data, it's all about using the tools and the program. So actually, without solving this problem, you can't do, you're not going to do the program because you've not got the data in the first place. And then we asked the kind of, you couldn't have a planning support system or a climate change adaptation tool that didn't. We did this through partly through a questionnaire and workshops, so it was kind of a catch-all, what would you like this tool to do? My colleague Sarah Lindley did a literature review of different types of tools that were available, so we, at the time we were aware of what other kind of tools were available. A whole range of tools at the time available, but most tended to operate at a very coarse spatial scale. The World Bank were developing, the UN were developing a global climate change adaptation tool, but the data was at a country level. So at the time we were developing this, there was nothing that went down to a neighbourhood level. We also reviewed available technology as well at the time. So things like Google Maps and their APIs was available, that's what we originally built the tool in. And through all this information we developed a functional specification and then went out to, well, we did some pilot testing initially with three of the partners using these storylines. One around heat stress in Catania in Sicily, one around surface water flooding in South London, and one around ice melts in Austria. So when the ice melts in the spring, they get all kinds of flooding problems further down the valley. And we went through a whole set of workshops where we had all the partners in Europe sat with laptops using the software, filling out a questionnaire, we were observing. There was nothing better than observing people using the software tool and actually being there in the room with them when they're using it, rather than just relying on sort of verbal or written feedback. Being actually there with them when they're using the tool is really insight about how you refine the tool and the kind of problems that you face with you around usability issues. And I mentioned after several iterations around this of user testing, refining, and going back to them, we then eventually implemented the tool. So these were the three storylines. So what essentially in soft systems methodology we call the use case, we call those storylines for our partners. So risk of flooding is some critical infrastructure protection in Styria, essentially like the ice melts, a lot of power stations, sewage treatment works can essentially get flooded and cause all kinds of problems. And then risk of high temperature, Catania is a town in Sicily. Now from a technical point of view, I think when I first came here some 14 years ago, no more than that, it was 1998 or something longer than that, at the time there was very few bits of software available that you could sort of go and download and use to deploy spatial data on the internet. So hence that's why we wrote something called GeoTools, which is still available as an open source software platform, and developed a Java application. But increasingly now, I think one of the biggest breakthroughs was the University of Minnesota when they developed their MapServe software. So if you're interested in using web mapping services, I don't know how you can quite easily just press the right buttons in ArcGIS and you connect web map servers and services. If you want to do this outside of an ArcGIS environment, the Minnesota MapServe is one of the longest standing pieces of open source free software. So if you just Google mapserver.org, you can get the MapServe software. You install it on your server. And what that allows you to do is serve out vector and raster data over the top of any kind of base map, whether that's Google Maps, Bing Maps, OpenStreetMap, OSA in space. So that will render, it will convert your vector and raster data into tiles of a certain resolution and render that over the top of your base map very quickly. And increasingly, a lot of this data now is being delivered through what we know as web mapping services, but I will come back to that in a moment. So, what we did was we used the map server libraries, the service to serve out the spatial data, and then we write JavaScript based widgets and tools on top of those services so we can build our own analysis tools and data manipulation tools on top of that spatial data. So for, at the time we used the Google Mapping version 2 of their API, it's recently changed to version 3, which has caused tremendous problems. Again, that I'll come back to. We have a map layer menu that was written in XML, so what we did, I'll show you later, was you think about when you're using Windows software and you're exploring through your files, you've got that kind of hierarchical structure, you click on folders and they expand. We used the same approach for the way in which we presented layers of data, because again, we think about the users of this tool are not GIS experts. Maybe you want to use something that's familiar to people who are familiar with computers, but not necessarily with GIS. And at the time, there was a lack of web mapping services. So you couldn't get Environment Agency maps live streaming from their web map services at the time. You couldn't get some computer from British Geological Survey here. You couldn't get the BGS data live streaming. You have to go and get your own copy of the data. So it required a horrendous, huge amount of offline data processing, manipulation, analysis of the source data before you could actually put that onto the servers and serve that out. Just to give you an idea, these are the parts across Europe that we worked with. And if you remember earlier, I was talking about the fact that some had a lot, these are ranked in terms of total. There's a Sutton and Southampton by far the most number of spatial data sets that were relevant to this. Kalamaria in Greece, the municipality at the time, only had 7 layers of data. So social infrastructure was things like, they knew where the hospitals were, where the community centres were. Civil infrastructure was things like, they knew where the electricity substations were. But, and right to the top where we got Sutton, we got a lot of data. So we went to each part and asked them about their data, what data was relevant to them to be in the tool. But a total of 293 layers, that's a lot of data that you've got to get. And these were all coming in different formats, mapping for extra shape file, and some bizarre formats we've never heard of, and managed to eventually get them all converted into shape file format. The tool also worked at an EU level as well, and there were 32 layers of data for the whole of the European level as well, although the partners were less concerned about this. And at the time, we were talking to the European Environment Agency, who now have a spatial data portal that maps a lot of this data. But at the time, that wasn't available. So at the time, it was uniquely bringing together all these layers. We worked with the EEA to talk to them about how you could actually serve a lot of this data as web mapping services. So a whole sort of 6 months or so, just processing the data. Gina Cameron, who's doing a brilliant job of taking this source data and getting it into a format. And as I said earlier, translating the language, the attribute data, in the attribute tables as well, and converting all the data into ArcGIS format, to ShapeRock format. Then attempting to convert it then into a common projection. So we're using Google Maps that uses the WGS 84 projection for Google. So you're getting all this data from different countries, different projections, and local projections, you have to reproject all of this. Web mapping services doesn't mean you don't need to worry about this kind of thing anymore. But at the time, they weren't available, so it's a tremendous job to just convert all this data. And then the problem with the UK partners and being obsessed with not using Google Maps, they were scared to death and put any of their data that might be derived from OS on top of a Google Map. So we had to then convert their data back into OSGB, so that we could display it on a very early version of OS Open Space. But it also required the creation of a lot of new data. Vulnerability indices, and I think Stuart might have talked about some of these last week, where you're sort of combining, it's a bit like an index of multiple deprivation, but for ones that are relevant to climate change, climate vulnerability data sets, where you create indices that are different from derived indices from different data sets. So there's still, even if, you know, moving down onto a sort of set where there's a lot more services frankly, a mapping divided online. You still have to do a lot of this offline processing if you want to produce your own analysis to feed back to your sort of user community. And for each one of those spatial data miners, think about it, we're dealing with a community who would be providing the map and they look at it and they probably don't really know how to understand or interpret what that map is telling them. So it'll be a legend that'll have their five bins in their area, you know, which are the percentage ranges, but it's still not really difficult for them to understand what that's meaning. So for every one of those layers, we wrote a couple of paragraphs that gave them a description of what that map was really telling them, why that data might be important, and that map of information that they're looking at, why that's important and relevant to climate change. And we also did links back to where the data had come from, so potentially you could go and get the data, the source data, download it yourself and do your own analysis. So, a horrendous job, very time consuming, and you've got so many data sets. And then we sort of populated, put this into relevant categories as well, so, you know, sort of 500 plus data sets, putting those into a sort of structure that made sense, actually, just to become clearer on our issue. Writing all the code. When you use MapServe, you have to write something called a map file, which then sort of serves out each layer and says things like scan, if you need five classes, what the breakpoints are in those classes. If you think you go to ArcGIS and you just click some buttons and it doesn't manage it. There is an add-on to ArcGIS that allows you to convert your MXD file into one of these map files, but it's a bit clunky and doesn't always work properly. But you have to manually type in all this code and say, well, what colour do you want? If you want this one to be a light shade of blue through to a dark shade of blue, then do all the red, green, blue codes. It's a bit time consuming. You read lots of literature, people say, oh, this is wonderful, web mapping services and methods for efficient. Someone still sat behind all that, having to write lines and lines of code. And then we, once we got all that, we deployed the first version, and this was our first version. So here we just zoomed into the London Borough of Sutton, and as the base layer was the aerial photography from Google Maps, and then you can overlay different layers of information. But this was part of that methodology of using workshops with the partners. And as you can see, it's the kind of the iterations of going through revising this, the interface changed. I kind of like to think it got a bit cleaner as we progressed through. And you can just see off the screen here one of the bits of metadata, so it's telling you what the map is actually showing you. Essentially, you can just overlay the data. We have slider bars that allow you to alter the transparency on each layer. And overlay sort of raster data, polygon data, data sets. So what I'm just going to try and do now is give you an idea of what this thing ended up looking like. So this is London Borough of Sutton. And we originally built a tool on Google Maps, but the UK partners, as I said earlier, insisted on us changing to OS OpenSpace. So we spent a lot of time developing tools and widgets on top of Google Maps, but and the Google Maps API. OS OpenSpace, if any of you have ever used that, uses something called OpenLayers, which is a library, an API. But the huge differences between the Google API and the OpenSpace API. So for example, what we never managed to crack in the short time we had left the project was for the UK partners, they didn't have slider bars to affect the transparency on the layer, which was a key problem really, but they insisted on using OS OpenSpace. So it created all kinds of problems that we never managed to fix as part of the project. But essentially you can turn layers on and off, and what it's essentially doing for the partners is allowing them to highlight where parts of their community might be at risk from different climate change scenarios. So the red areas are areas at risk of surface water flooding, and the dark blue area, the light blue to dark blue areas are where sort of these areas here, these lighter blue ones, which because of the transparency is difficult to see, well, it's impossible really, so we need to turn it off. But what it essentially says is people who live in these areas, just over 94% of households in those areas live in basement flats. And if you then turn on the flooding data, some areas here, because of that transparency problem of swapping to OSI, some of these areas here, which you would risk flooding in areas where there are people in basement flats, is allowing them for a certain amount of development. This adaptation plan is making them think about, well, what do they need to do in those parts of the community, where there's a high proportion of people living in basement flats, and they're also at risk of surface water flooding. Whereas what we were able to do more recently, so this does show you, because a few years later we then developed a similar version for Greater Manchester, and we had an updated version of open layers, and it then became much easier to do the transparency on open layers. So things do, you know, the development environment changes, the tools that were available to us change, things updated, libraries get updated. So it means that we could, with this, when we developed this about 18 months after the Grabs project, just for the Greater Manchester area, we were allowed to add in the slide bars, whereas at the time, say, allowed, we basically programming meant that you could do something you couldn't do before, because the open layers API had had new things added to it, and then it allowed us to map this. So we've got here the dark areas, houses in poor condition, and overlaying that with flooding data, and if those houses get flooded, you need to know very quickly, well, where do you move those people out from their houses, and these are leisure centres, and what are often used when you need to evacuate people from their houses, they often get one of the emergency centres often using the leisure centres. So there's links there to the two, the Graphs tool and also the EcoCities tool. All of these tools are written in open source software as well, so you can get the source code and you can redeploy these essentially in any other municipality, anywhere in the world. So you essentially take the code and you change a few lines in that code, and instead of the map zooming in to a particular part of the UK or Europe, you can zoom into any other place around the world. So the tool that we developed, the online tool, the key finding of areas, as I said at the start, was to support decision making, support development of these adaptation action plans. And some of the partners used it in community engagement, community consultation with neighbourhood groups. So in Southampton, they used the tool in libraries and community centres with residents in social housing, because they were making changes and adapting the surrounding area, natural environment around town blocks and social housing. They used the tool to explain to the residents why they would be coming along and making changes to the natural environment around, within their community, by explaining that, you know, under different scenarios, particularly around flooding, but equally around surface temperature increases. So we've increasingly have what we call surface sea in a lot of our areas. I think the whole of Greater London now, you're not allowed to tarline your front garden. People were covering their gardens in tarmacs and park 3 or 4 cars in front of the garden. That's creating lots of surface water runoff. One of the reasons why we seem to get so much localised flooding these days is not necessarily getting more rain than used to. It's because we concrete tarmac and pave absolutely everywhere, so people can park where they want in their front gardens. So going into the community and saying, well, there's a reason why we're doing this, and you're showing them through, so it also becomes an educational tool, an informing tool around why you're carrying out a particular policy. We're doing this because if we don't, this is what will happen. So, and also for raising awareness among politicians. We probably all know you show a politician a map of something, and that really gets through to them much more than a 10-page report would ever do. We also found that GIS highlights rather than solves data deficiencies, so that story of the different departments within Southampton Council not talking to each other at all. They had to go through this process of data collection. They sort of realised they got data sets they didn't realise. But there are also problems around the fact that for some partners they have very coarse spatial data. And when you provide a tool that allows people to zoom in to a particular area, what you can do, so for example, the Environment Agency flood zone data. You have to make it turn, if you zoom in so far, you have to make that data turn off and disappear because of the impacts that it might have, particularly around insurance and lightning insurance for certain houses. So, you know, if you're on one side of the flood risk zone or the other, can have a whole understanding of that on climate change. On insurance. The scale at which you allow people to zoom in and out can depend on the resolution and the type of data that you provide. And it highlighted the importance of providing metadata as well. So we all hate the thought of having to maintain and keep metadata. But when you have such a large number of data sets, it's a really key aspect of the tool to have metadata there that people can then understand about where the data is coming from, the source of the data. And as I said, it opened up dialogue and they learned about the benefits of sharing their data. Now, the latest things we've been working on, there's two projects which I'm working on at the moment. One is for the Joseph Braintree Foundation, their climate just project, as well as we've worked on, which is looking at the impacts of climate change on more vulnerable parts of the UK in terms of more vulnerable sectors of society. And the other project is something through the UK government's technology strategy board. They had a call out last year under what we call the innovative uses of environmental data. And what we're doing there again is a climate change related project. But the biggest improvement really from when we worked on the GRASH project to what we're doing now is the fact that more and more data is now available through web mapping services. So the big advantage of this is that we don't need to go and get a copy of the flooding data from the Environment Agency. Because if it gets changed or updated, it's pulled live through web map services from the Environment Agency, so if they change that data, we don't need to worry about it. And whilst that's not new, these web mapping services have been around for a long time. The vast majority of the kind of data that we use and require for these kind of tools, these support, decision support systems, planning support systems, is still not provided in these ways. The national kind of agencies are much better at providing data through web map services than local level data. So despite what you can read, and there's, not, you know, there's journals dedicated to this kind of stuff, there's still a heck of a lot here, still again just touching the surface really. There's a heck of a vast majority of data, and public data as well, it's publicly available data, is still not provided in these kind of ways. But that's mainly because you still need to do your own manipulation and analysis on the data. You want to do your own interpretation or analysis to present back to people, depending on what you're using that data for. So what all I was going to just do, literally the last slide, is just to show you. So for example, this is the Technology Strategy Board project. So we're working with the Housing Association. This is all their housing stock across the southwest of England. So that's a shared file that they gave to us. We've got attribute information on there that allows to map things like we know if we can colour the dots for all the properties that are on the basement, we can colour the dots for all the properties that are on the sixth floor or above, because they're going to be affected by heat stress. But in the past, we would have gone to, in the GRASH tool, the ecosystem tool, we went to the Environment Agency and got a copy of the flooding data. Essentially now, we get the flood alert data directly from the Environment Agency, from their web map service. And if they change that map, we don't need to go and, we don't need to keep following and keep track. I don't need to be going every other day onto the Environment Agency website to keep track of whether or not they've updated their data. It just comes in seamlessly. And equally, we can do the same with our lives. Talking to the guys from BGSNA, I suspect that the BGS data probably doesn't change that much. But equally, the geology data. And what we've not added on here is the mining data as well. Because what the Housing Association are interested in for this tool is their current stock. What risks might that current stock be up from climate change, different impacts? But also, if they're going to purchase new housing stock, that might already be built, might go and purchase some local authority housing, or what they call stock transfers to a local authority housing association. They don't necessarily want to be investing in housing that's in an area that's liable to flooding or different climate change scenarios. And equally, they might want to be purchasing pieces of land which they might want to develop in the future if that, again, is affected by climate change. So that's been a big improvement in the fact that we can increasingly now get a lot of our data live through these web map services. But there's still, if you look through it, we've not added things yet. But things like the urban heat island effect, we have to model that, process that, log that offline in our GIS. We can't go somewhere and get an e-tiling mapping service at the moment. So there's still a lot of data that you have to process yourself, which probably keeps you all happy if you're doing you're either working in GIS consultancy or doing a master's in GIS. You probably don't know that this kind of stuff is going to become easy for anyone to be doing. There's still a lot of work for GIS professionals to be doing around not just building these kind of sites, but processing a lot of data on the phone as well. And that's being done. So I guess we've got time for questions.
Yes. Thank you very much. Yes.
I think some hide behind, less so now, a lot of hiding behind data protection. can release this data because of copyright. That was a big stumbling block. Increasingly, we can overcome those problems.
So it gets traced back in any way to the OS, they always play that card.
Well, some strange things are happening at the moment. So LiDAR data has suddenly just become available, has become available. It's been available through the Environment Agency, not through the LS. You can get LiDAR data for free for non-commercial use.
Look into that again. I actually had a, I'll take the chair, sort of chair's question, almost, not quite, but there was one of your slides, just a passing thought, you're almost getting onto it, the community centres used as refuges. Obviously, it depends on the spatial distribution of community centres, but I think, can you actually go as far as sort of allocating zones or getting the closest facilities, sort of thing, enough centres? Is that something, a sort of network, the things you would do in network analysis? Is that
for some of them, what they realised was that their leisure centres or sites for recovery, which the emergency planners would call them, weren't necessarily in the right places. So they were then thinking, well, we might need to think about the next time we build a new sports centre or leisure centre, or we locate it in this place because it's not being impacted by flood risk or heat stress, which isn't something we tend to think about in this country, but increasingly heat stress will become overcome. So remember a few years ago, those pensioners in Paris who died and were left at home over the summer, and their younger relatives went to the south of France. Getting people out of their homes into places with air conditioning will increasingly become an issue. So making sure you've got those kind of facilities in the right parts of your cities, that's one way in which the tool was being used by some voters to think more about, well, we should think really about where we locate those kinds of facilities in a way that they'd not thought before.
Yeah. That's interesting because, with my teaching hat on again, we have our intro practical and kind of a fanciful scenario of can we sort of throw schools at a town to cater for everyone, which is obviously stretching credulity as a sort of planner I don't know if that ever went on, but it may actually sort of occur now if they have to think in different ways. Sort of where to build rather than making the best of what's built. Bruce, question.
You made the case very effectively that we've sort of moved from a situation where, especially in a sort of research environment, you build these little demonstrators and spend a huge amount of time and effort doing them, and then they never go anywhere, to the situation we're now in, where these are built on open software with open data and are very reusable. But I wonder if you're seeing that actually happen with your software, and if you're not, what drivers we need to put in place. It was a discussion we had in the Scottish public sector that if you've got a team of local authorities that are all doing the same thing, why doesn't we just create it and then say, right, okay, you guys all use this. But no, it's really quite happening again.
My example of that is the current project with Joseph Rentry, where the Graphs tool was used in the municipalities that kind of listed. Essentially, the Rentry project is doing a Graphs for the UK at middle super urban area level. So, thanks to the Joseph Rentry Foundation, they're funding a nationwide adaptation toolkit. The focus for them is because of who they are, is on vulnerable, socially vulnerable communities. But actually, they're the people that it should have been targeted, because for affluent people can afford to buy the proper flood gates. I suppose the comment is that a lot of our proposals sign up to big contracts with
well, let's go past this.
Yes, Dave, there's always been the counter argument, hasn't there? There's other ways of doing it, but local authorities. But, well, most organisations are risk averse, and the fact that you kind of feel, well, there's a helpline, so I can pick up. Whereas actually, if you're employed, because you have GIS in your organisation, you still have GIS technicians doing what they like. Those GIS technicians could actually be doing it this way. And instead of spending lots of money on the software, you spend money on the staff who can build and deliver a bespoke service. And there are examples of that. I think the east of England, or certainly the East Anglia, they all worked together and saved a lot of money. Instead, invested the money in the staff to build the tools that they need. But that's not the norm. And I don't think that's a GIS thing, that's generally software generally.
Yes, you said something about the complexity of all these too many systems. I came across something the other day, there was Oracle this and Oracle that. I'm not having a go at Oracle, but there's lots of salesmen pushing systems at great costs.
I mean, it is the same though in the open source community, because there's open layers that we strategy. But then there's other libraries now, there's constantly, like one of my PhD students was in his first 6 months of doing a review at the moment of all these different services, just not at all to stop with the desk. She'll never stop, but then new ones coming along all the time, so it's really great, but you've got to sometimes just go, well, that's enough now, to concentrate on this one. So it's the same problem that exists.
Yeah, it is an interesting reflection. I guess there's some egos tied up in these things, but you just kind of wish you'd say, well, let's collaborate a bit more and make that one better rather than creating another one.
Yeah, I suppose the best example of that is QGIS.
Yeah, yeah.
As a sort of driver to our GIS. Yeah.
Yeah, it's something we can get hold of.
I see this as a sort of information gathering and distributing tools, but my understanding is participation is that it's a two-way process between the public being able to use the GIS tools to convey their message back to providers of the information.
Yeah.
So what have you done to enable the participatory aspect?
What people do is, although it doesn't work on it anymore, because you won't be bombarded with lots of the is it allows me to ground truth and ask questions about the data. So you could originally, when the versions that get used weren't being used, because for each part of that version, when they deploy it, you could zoom in, you could click on a location and sort of question, hold on a minute. According to this, it's floating a world. I've lived here 18 years ago, it's never flooded, or look out of the view of my across the fields here, it flooded 20 years ago, and it's not on the Oregon Valley Agency flood map, so we allow people to kind of ground truth. I suppose now volunteer geographic information, I suppose, is now called, and crowdsourced data of their own personal experience. But then you get, you sort of recommend people, well, yes, but it's about probability. 1 in 100 chance of a flood. So you can get into interesting discussions with sort of the general public about their understanding of what that map is showing. Because just because it's never flooded there doesn't mean that it always floods 6 times in 5 years and you think, well, the map didn't say that because they don't understand the risk of the flood. So there is that functionality. A lot of the other work we do is around. So we've got one tool that is like a threaded discussion, Facebook-style commenting to question it. But the problem is if you then need someone in the municipality to respond to that, and most of the time they don't want to, they're not interested. Because to see that is really a bit like a data question, but it's like a burden, and it's an extra job to do.
I was thinking if I'm a 80-year-old granny living in a high flood-risk area, if I go on there and I see that home of some refugee is actually like 5 miles away, and then one subway sort of shoots here, this is the refuge, it's the closest over here, how's she going to get from there to there? What are the plans? What should she
do? That sort of thing. I mean, it's in a way the tool then led it the sort of the rather dull and usual sort of policy document that would be like 50 pages long, would have all the text in it. But you could make that much more interactive. None of the partners did, but they could have actually put links that apply back into the tool that will show you things like that. What are they doing? You can put the proposal, so what's the plan saying? The adaptation plan, is it now proposing that there will be a new centre for recovery closer to the river?
There's also this one question, second I was just saying, complexities. I was interested in as to whether, just because it's in a flood zone, it actually floods the buildings off the ground, multi-storey, and does coastal inundation, does it actually reach that area, or are the barriers, artificial walls perhaps, or other barriers? So it's, how really detailed are the flood maps? But anyway, I think I should take more.
Yeah, I was also a bit confused about the part where it actually supports decision making rather than visualization of already made decisions. And also I was thinking, could it be used as an input for company, reinsurance companies or flood risk insurance?
In terms of supporting decision making, what it was there for was as a set of baseline information, but also the climate change, the downscale climate change scenario data. So it was there to feed into a policy document about what that municipality was going to do in terms of plans and proposals for adapting to deal with what the tool was telling them about areas. Vulnerable communities that might be at risk of flooding, what adaptation response. So what would have been interesting that wasn't really part of the project would have been to have taken their spatial planning maps at the back of their documents and overlay those back into the tool. The interesting thing was the tool was a minor part of the project, but in the end actually became the major part of the project because they all got excited about the fact that this will support, we needed the evidence base, and we haven't appreciated when the proposal went in. But it's a typical kind of thing where I have a phone call saying, we're going to do some online mapping, so we just want a few maps on the website as part of this project, not 560.
I'm sorry. All right, I think that might let you off the hook. That takes us nicely into GeoDrinks territory. So, just say thanks a lot, but firstly, thanks all for coming, and thanks all to my team of helpers who did a sterling job turning the room around. So just remains, it's a talk, it's probably another couple of weeks for the next talk, so we look forward to that. But now, just to say thank you very much to Richard.